Luke 6, verses 37 through 42, our text for the sermon this morning. Last time, we looked just at verse 37, and we made some distinctions. We talked about the kinds of judgments that we are not to make. Jesus says, judge not. And we saw that we're not to make harsh judgments of other people, not to be overly severe with them. We're not to make inadequately informed judgments. Things are complicated. Circumstances, people are complex. There's so much that we don't know. We're not to make premature judgments. We need to know the facts. We need to wait and not engage in a societal favorite, a rush to judgment. We're not to judge other people on the basis of our own personal preferences and infringe upon Christian liberty by judging others and their use of money, or how they choose to educate their children, or whether or not they use alcoholic beverages, or the areas of ministry that they get involved in. There are judgments that we must make. He's not asking us to abandon the distinction between right and wrong. We need to continue to distinguish good from evil, and justice from injustice, and liberty from tyranny, and virtue from vice. So there are judgments that we must make. Jesus is not nullifying those or destroying those categories, but he is saying that we're to avoid these kinds of wrongful judgments, as we were making the overall point that we're to make charitable judgments when we are evaluating others and circumstances and places and times. One other that we want to say under this overall rubric of charitable judgments, we are to avoid judgments based on worldly distinctions. I think this is particularly a problem, and I think it's a problem everywhere from the nursery to the nursing home. We make these distinctions. We decide who we want to befriend and who we want to speak to and who we will take an interest in based upon worldly criteria, their appearance, their clothes, their class, their race, the region of the country from which they originate. The Apostle James deals directly with this in his second chapter, in which he gives the example of a rich person coming into the assembly and a poor person coming in. And he says, this is in James 2, 1 through 4. He says, look, the poor person comes in and you tell him to sit in the back or over there by your footstool. The rich person you honor and you give him the place of prominence and a comfortable place to sit. And he says, you become judges with distinctions. This is what he says, James 2, and verse 4, have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? What does he mean by evil motives? Well, you're making judgments, you're making distinctions based upon self-interest. That which will benefit me. He says this is contrary to the royal law of love. You have these evil motives. You're making these calculations, aren't you, about, is this a person who will benefit me? Do I have something to gain from them? Is this someone whose company I might enjoy? And we pursue those for whom the answer is yes, and we ignore and avoid all the rest. This is to make a judgment, a wrongful kind of judgment, with evil motives, he says. I mentioned to the inquirer's class last week that, you know, after 25 years, I've noticed a phenomena that happens. And that is, there's two kinds of new members. We have new members who join, and they come here and they don't know anybody. And they don't know a soul. And yet they come in and they embrace the whole fellowship of the church. And over a period of a couple of years, when we look at them again, we find that their best friends, their dearest, closest friends in all the world are the members of this church. And then I've seen another kind of new member come and join the church and look around for people who are just like they are. Looking for people who are of their class, of their level of education, and this sort of thing, and look past everyone that doesn't quite fit the description. I've also watched over the years people come in, visit, and judge us, and look around and see everyone who is so carefully groomed, and say, oh, these are just a bunch of snobby rich people. I don't have anything in common with them. And the reality is, actually, we have a whole lot of poor people. We got a whole lot of regular folks. We got blue collar and white collar. We got highly educated and barely educated. We run the whole spectrum. We've got old, we've got young. We we're a diverse congregation in all of the categories that I think really are the important categories. And yet these kinds of judgments are being made. What kind of judgments? Judgments based upon worldly criteria. And the point that Jesus is making is that these judgments restrict love. And you find them being made everywhere. His point is that you're to love your neighbor and to love your enemy. And when you make these kinds of distinctions, you make these kind of wrongful judgments, you are constricting the sphere in which love is able to operate. And as James puts it, you're doing so with the corrupt motives, determining only to love those from whom I have something to gain. Some benefit comes by knowing them. There's something that I get from my association with them. And in the meantime, rejecting and taking no interest in at all and inquiring no further about those who don't fit into the categories, the worldly categories, the carnal categories that I think are truly important. These judgments that are based on class and education and region and race constrict the realm in which love is operative. And so Jesus' point is that we are to love charitably and judge charitably. Whoever comes across our path, be slow to form an opinion and give the benefit of the doubt. That then moves us to Roman numeral number 2 on love and judgment. Number 1 was judge charitably. Number 2 is judge generously. Look at verse 38. Give and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. They will pour into your lap. For whatever measure you deal out to others, it will be dealt to you in return. Now, typically these words are interpreted in terms of stewardship. And during stewardship season, we urge people to give monetarily. And I really think, well, that's a legitimate, you can generalize, and that's a legitimate application. It's not really the focus. It's not really the point that Jesus was making here. Seeing that there's a continuation of the theme of judgment and of mercy and love, I think that what he's talking about is generosity in our judgments. Giving, like I say, the benefit of the doubt. Giving grace, giving the mercy that he mentioned in verse 36. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Forgive generously. Minimize the faults of others generously rather than maximize their faults. And he says, if you do that, if you give, it will be given to you. In other words, that generosity of spirit that gives the benefit of the doubt in judgment will be extended to you as well, whether by God or by our neighbors. And the metaphor that he's using is that of measuring grain or flour. And you take your little measuring cup, don't you, and you fill it up. And imagine yourself at the market and an open market, and they're filling it up, and you want to get the full 2 cups. So what do? You shake it down. And you might even press it down. And he's saying here, if you are the one who is giving, you shake it down, you press it down, and fill it until it runs over. You know, there's a hamburger place here in town where if you buy French fries, they put the cup in the bag, and they fill it to overflowing. It spills over into the bag. That's the kind of image that he's using here. Don't be a tightwad about your forgiving other people and pardoning them and extending grace to them and mercy to them and giving them that benefit of the doubt and being slow to judge what they've done or how they've handled themselves or what there's been about their behavior that has been bothersome or annoying. Let your generosity, he's saying, be overflowing. That's the point. Jesus was asked by the disciples, how many times shall we forgive? 7 times? And Jesus said, no, 70 times 7. That's generosity in our judgments and assessments of other people. Contrast that with the merciless, those who lack this generosity. What invariably is the case is they have what Hebrews 12:15 calls this root of bitterness within them. This root of bitterness regarding others and ultimately regarding God himself. And because of that, there's this consistent flow of bitter harsh criticism of others. It spews out with respect to every real or imagined offense, whether it's large or small, whether it's significant or petty. They're making mountains out of molehills rather than generosity in their compassion, generosity in their sympathy and forgiveness. No slack is cut. No quarter is given. All who disagree are judged to be knaves and fools. Resentment is nursed and then relived. For years, this goes on unresolved. Jesus says, give and it will be given to you. We have the resources as Christians. We've been forgiven, haven't we? We've been pardoned, haven't we? There's now no condemnation. The judgment has been lifted from us. We've been spared the judgment. We're in a position now to extend that pardon, extend that forgiveness, withhold the judgment, because the judgment has been withheld from us. We have at our disposal the emotional resources, the gospel resources, the healing resources, as it were, to withhold the judgment, to be generous in our assessments. Has God not been generous with us? Can we not then in response be generous in turn and give of ourselves and give of our time and give of our money and give of our sympathy and our compassion and our understanding rather than harshly judging others? Roman numeral 3. Love requires discernment. We had to have charitable judgments and generous judgments. And yet love, which requires charitable and generous judgments, also requires discernment from us. That's how I understand the transition into verse 39, where again, I think he's continuing to talk about judgments and love providing the criteria for judgments. He says in verse 39, that he spoke a parable to them, a blind man cannot guide a blind man, can he? Will they not both fall into a pit? So what he's offering the corrective that we've already mentioned, that love does not require an acceptance of everything an abandonment of all criteria of truth and error and right and wrong. In fact, love not only does not demand that, but love, in fact, provides the criteria by which to evaluate spiritual leaders. A blind man, he says in verse 39, cannot guide a blind man. What's he blind to? This teacher, this guide, is blind to the requirements of love. And he's trying to guide disciples who at this point are ignorant of the requirements of love. And what he does then is he leads them into a pit, into disaster. What kind of teachers might these be? Well, Jesus identified them in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:43, who say, love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. He says, look, if you have a teacher who does not understand something so basic as the requirement that we love everyone that we encounter, our enemies and our neighbors, they're going to mislead you as well in all manner of things, because love properly understood, love in the context of truth, governs all of our actions and all of our responses and all of our words and even all of our thoughts. And so if this so-called teacher, this guide, is blind to the requirements of love, he can't uninstruct one who has yet not learned the requirements of love, but rather will mislead this person ultimately in disaster. Continuing in verse 40, the same thing. A pupil is not above his teacher. In other words, you're going to rise no higher than that of your teacher. And if you have a teacher who is blind to the requirements of love and is teaching you to hate your enemy and indulge your bigotry and your prejudice and your hostility and animosity toward others, you will not rise above that. A pupil is not above his teacher, but everyone, after he has been fully trained, will be like his teacher. Now, this is particularly the case in the ancient world, where there weren't libraries and schools. That what you learned from your teacher. Everything he knew, he taught you, but you knew no more than what he taught. And you tried to absorb from him everything that he had to teach. But in the end of the process, you were no better than your teacher. You only knew what your teacher taught you. And when you have been fully trained or fully instructed, you will be like that teacher. Teachers reproduce themselves. That's why one needs to be careful about one's teachers. Pick them carefully. This is a frightening verse for preachers. I hope you understand that. To think everyone's going to turn out like the preacher. You agree? That's a pretty scary thought, isn't it? That's a bit unsettling. The Apostle Paul can say, be imitators of me, even as I am of Christ. You won't find me saying that. I'm going to say imitate Christ. I'm going to leave out the clause that says imitate me. Escape the implications of this as one might. And nevertheless, what he's saying is true. The pupils are going to turn out like their teachers. You have loveless teachers, you'll have loveless congregations. You have hateful teachers, you're going to have hateful congregations. They are going to reproduce pupils, students, disciples, congregations in their own image. This is going to happen. It's inevitable that this is going to happen. That's why we have to be careful about who we choose to be our teachers. If your teacher is judgmental, you're going to be judgmental. On the other hand, if your teacher is spineless and abandons the truth, don't be surprised if you have no moral courage either and shy away from the proclamation of the truth when one ought to be shouting it from the rooftops. Jesus of the Pharisees, Matthew 23:15, spoke of the proselytizing Pharisees, that they turned their disciples into twice the sons of hell that they are themselves. This is why James says, let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, for as such you shall incur a stricter judgment. I think in some ways the internet has made all of this even more of a problem because the internet is virtually uncensored. Everyone has a platform. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry becomes an expert and blogs and propagates his views. And there's none of the normal filtering like publishing houses or pulpit committees or governing bodies sanctioning an individual as a teacher or as a preacher or as an author. All of those tended to restrict this and filter out the aberrant, the defective, the heretical. And those checks are not in place when it comes to this. And so you've got all manner of teachers out there. And Jesus' words were never more important than they are right now. Be careful whom you adopt as a teacher across the spectrum. We have those who are harsh and condemning and judgmental. On the other hand, we have those who will not preach the truth in love, as the Apostle Paul tells Timothy. Don't abandon the truth in the name of love. Preach it. Preach that truth, but in love. Don't shy away from that. In season, out of season. Be faithful. So he's saying, be discerning about those whom you choose to be your teacher. So just get the balance right so that you're not making these kind of uncharitable and ungenerous judgments, but you're not abandoning the responsibility to judge altogether. Now, this is the case we can see as we move on to Roman numeral number 4, which is that love requires integrity. It requires charitable judgments and generous judgments. It requires discernment about our teachers, but it also requires integrity. Or better yet, it requires humility or a sense of fair play. Verse 41, and why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but you do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Jesus is indulging a little humor here, isn't he? You see that this is funny. All right, he's not a stand-up comic, but this is funny. You've got a log in your eye, and you're looking over at the guy who's got a little speck in his eye. I mean, the visuals here are exceptional, aren't they? Here's a log in the eye, distorting vision, blocking vision. And you're making these judgments about somebody over there who's got a little tiny speck in his eye. You've got this plank, and he's got a little chip. And you're going to make a judgment about it. He's saying this, that Jesus is pointing to the typical. This is what typically is happening in our judgments. We have this propensity, don't we, to pick out the faults of others while we condone or ignore or fail to see our own. They have specks or little chips. We've got logs. We've got these beams in our eyes. Verse 42, or how can you say to your brother, brother, let me take out the speck that is in your eye when you yourself do not see the log that is in your own eye? See, we not only have the propensity to make a judgment, but now I'm going to be helpful to you, right? I'm going to come to your aid. You needed my assistance. And who am I? I'm the person with the log in my eye. And you're the person with the speck, and you need my help. I am so utterly blind to the circumstances, to the reality, as we confront each other, me with my log and you with your speck, that I propose that I serve as your assistant in getting the speck out of your eye, not realizing this log that is in the way. Jesus says, you hypocrite. A hypocrite is somebody that play acts. First, take the log out of your own eye. Then you will see clearly. The problem, you see, is that you can't see clearly because of the log, can you? In other words, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what you're dealing with. You can't see properly into that other person's life with this log in your eye. Then you'll see clearly to take out the speck that is in your brother's eye. You see, he does say that we should be helping others with their specks, doesn't he? Specks are bad things. Specks are irritating. They're annoying. They hurt. They mar your vision. Removing specks are good. Specks are harmful. Get rid of specks. Helping others with their specks is a good thing. But it's only a good thing if you deal with the log first. That's the point. So we do make judgments, right? A speck is a speck. However, a log is a log. So we're assuming here that the judgments can be made. There are speck-free eyes. There are also log-free eyes. And specks are not logs. And so we make a distinction between serious matters and those that are far less serious. Those things that are just mere specks versus things that are of huge, encumbering proportions that are logs. And so Jesus is saying, look, all of you, you need to deal with the logs. Logs are incomparably worse than specks. If you're having an affair, don't go criticize the fellow who's not tithing all his money. Right? What is it about your concern about the fellow who's not tithing when you're running around breaking the seventh commandment? Get a sense of proportion about things. Maybe you're misappropriating funds at work. Maybe you're robbing your employer. But you've got this neighbor who's not cutting his lawn promptly, and his yard looks like a mess, and he's hurting property values. And so you're critical of the neighbor who's not getting his lawn mowed promptly, and you're robbing your employer. This person's perspective is warped, isn't it? Their sense of proportion is out of balance. There's an unequal concern. There's a condoning of one's own problems and a condemning of the problems of others, even though their problems are relatively minor and my problems are vast. Most of us have a veritable forest of logs in our eyes. And yet we're picking at people because of their specks. We're irritated with them. We're critical of them. We're We're criticizing them because they have these little specks that bother us. And our eyes are this jungle of inconsistencies and corruptions. And there we are harping on the problems that everyone else has. And we're blind to the scale of problems that we just simply tolerate in ourselves all the time. Judge not, Jesus says. You need to first deal with yourself before you start to deal with other people. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but you do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Is that not a propensity that we all share? Isn't this typical of us? Isn't this one of those twisted elements of human nature that we fix upon the speck that is in the other person's eye while we ignore, while we condone, while we tolerate the log that is within our own? How can you say, he's just aghast, isn't he? How can you say to your brother, brother, let me take out the speck that is in your eye. Let me help you. Let me offer your assistance with that speck that you have, this little problem that you have when you yourself do not see the log that is in your own eye. All right. Brother so-and-so drives too fast. He breaks the speed limit. That's a bad thing. You know, the civil magistrates, Romans 13, we're supposed to obey them. We're not supposed to speed. You should obey the law. So-and-so, you know, every once in a while he drinks a little too much. He goes just slightly over the limit. He's irresponsible. All right, he shouldn't do that. You know, drunkenness is a sin. Just flat out, drunkenness is a sin. There's no Christian person that should ever indulge it. How does that compare, though, with somebody who is a hater, as we say these days, who won't have anything to do with anyone who's any different than they are, who extends no love, no sympathy, no compassion, shows no kindness, no mercy toward others? And maybe the person is perfectly orthodox and perfectly moral and keeps all the commandments, but nevertheless harshly condemning of other people, withholds mercy, extends no sympathy, is uncharitable in his assessments of others. That's a log, all right? The greatest commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself, isn't it? No, that's the second greatest. The greatest is to love God. Second greatest, though, is to love your neighbor. If you're not loving your neighbor, you don't have any business then helping everyone else with the specks that are in their eyes. If I'm a Christian, let me back up. Last week, we repeated several times, the greatest need that the world has is for the disciples of Christ to live the ethics of Christ, for the ethics of Christ to be lived out in the lives of his disciples. I think that's the greatest need in the world. Let your good works shine let your good works shine before men, that they may see them and glorify your Father who is in heaven. We're to be children of God above reproach, light shining in the world, in the midst of a wicked and perverse generation, Philippians 2. All right, that is the great need that we have of our time, in my opinion. And the fact is, if I'm a Christian, I have experienced mercy. I have experienced grace. I have come to God with a mountain of indebtedness, with infinite debt for my sin. It's all been forgiven. It's all been pardoned. The slate's been wiped clean. The very idea that I cannot turn around now and extend the mercy to other people, extend love to them and kindness to them, withhold my harsh and premature and ill-informed and worldly-based judgments from them, but extend mercy and love and kindness to them, it shows, I think, ultimately, there's a defect in my understanding of what happened at the cross and what it means to be a Christian. To be a Christian means the infinite weight of my sin has been taken from my shoulders and my record has been wiped clean, and there's there now no condemnation because I'm in Christ Jesus. And so, in response, what do? I extend that to others. I extend it to others. My vast debt has been forgiven. I can extend the forgiveness and mercy to others. If you've been on the receiving side of unwarranted judgments, just apply the golden rule. You've had people judge your motives, and they were all wrong. You've had people misinterpret your words, and they had it all wrong. They were completely 180 degrees wrong. What they interpreted you to mean was antithetical to what you intended, and they judged and condemned you and would have nothing to do with you because of it. You know what it's like to experience that. You know what it's like to be shunned, to be excluded, to be pushed aside, to be thought unworthy of attention because of the judgments others have been made based on appearances, externals. But because we know these things, then we ought not to indulge them ourselves, right? Let us then love one another, even as Christ has loved us, as we pray together.